Welcome. Welcome everyone, also online. What does it feel like to be in the ivory tower? Today, the Zukunftskolleg has a retreat. A retreat. The Zukunftskolleg is we have many people from outside who are joining us, so I'll take one or two sentences. The Zukunftskolleg is an institution to give an academic home to young researchers across disciplines, across the world, also across different stages in their career, going from very young postdocs all the way to senior fellows who are here in the room or in the Zukunftskolleg. And today we have, as I said, a retreat. We are in a castle somewhere in the vicinity of Konstanz, of Stockach. It feels totally outside. It feels like the ivory tower, like being in a sort of protected environment to think about research, to think about what it means to discover new things, and under what circumstances, in what kind of environment do we do that? What kind of values do we live? Or do we project, or do we expect from others in our academic and in our research life? Within the Zukunftskolleg, we have prepared this topic. We already had a pre-meeting in one of our Jour fixes, and the diversity of points of views that we elaborated in that respect was quite astounding and very interesting. Certainly worth going more into detail. And tomorrow, with the fellows, we will have a full day of discussions, of workshops to go into depth. But sometimes being in an ivory tower is like being lost. Being left alone, isolated, somewhat without the real contact to the real world. And so we thought we need the real world. We need the contact to life. And I'm really, really grateful and happy to have our guest today here. You know him because you already see this. You know Jan Martin Viada is here. He is a journalist. He is a political journalist. He is an education journalist. He is very, very active in the German academic world, always opening up hidden things that work and that don't work, and helping in that way also German academia to be at the forefront also. With respect to the values that we live and the values that we represent to society and to the entire world. And therefore, I'm really, really very happy that we could convince you to come into the landscape of Stockach. Also because, you know, I mean, doing, helping, giving advice is not only something that happens and that you give or that you take, it also does something with you. Now, Jan Martin Viada did his PhD thesis on this very topic, right? On the question, what does counseling do with the counselor, right? Pinpointing that there's always a relationship and there was always a back and forth. Now, we spoke a little bit beforehand and you asked me not to say too much about yourself, which is very convenient for me, but which has a logic that you will tell us. Thank you very, very much for being here and for starting this discussion. Now, also for the people who are online, we will have this opening talk. After the opening talk, we will have fairly short, but depending on the questions, acceptable span of time where I would ask mostly the online people to ask questions, which we will take from the chat. We will not have verbal questions from the online community, but we will take these questions from the chat. At a certain point, we will then close the online part of the evening And we will continue here on site. And we will have a report. If you are interested, online people, then please do contact us. You will get more information about what is then happening tonight and will happen tomorrow. Thank you all again. And Ms. Helvera, Dr. Viada, the stage is yours.
Thank you so much for this very nice welcome. So I'm the real world, I just learned. So hello, everybody, dear Zukunftskolleg of the University of Konstanz and dear viewers, wherever you have turned in from. I'm very happy to be here today. The journey, the travel from Berlin to Hohenfels Castle, somewhere in the middle of somewhere, not too far from Lake Constance, was long. It was quite a ride, and I really enjoyed it, because it's an honor to be here today, to be able to speak, to discuss things with you later, dealing with some of the brightest minds of the young and not so young anymore generation of scientists is always a great thing for a science journalist. And then, in addition to that, as part of the postdoc appreciation week, which I have the privilege to support twice, today here at Hohenfels Castle, and on Thursday in Potsdam at the Brandenburg Postdoc Network. That's a good fit, because I believe that there can never be enough appreciation for postdocs, not only during postdoc appreciation week. Without you and your work, and I mean that quite honestly, nothing would work in the German science system. How ironic, however, that some of those responsible for the science system still don't seem to understand that quite enough. Well, I've been asked to talk about values, about the value of values. That's the title of my keynote speech. Sounds catchy, but what does I actually mean by that? And what can I actually tell you? I'm neither a philosopher nor an active scientist. And I don't know whether I'm an authority, or do I really look that old already? So who is standing here in front of you with what right to speak to you in what role? Perhaps I should start by telling you a little bit more about who you are dealing with, what I do for a living, and how it came about. So I did my A-levels in Berlin, after which I wanted to become a teacher for Latin and German. I went to Munich to study, and there it was, the first reality shock of my still young academic life. As I said, I wanted to be a teacher, I wanted to learn to be a teacher, but suddenly I was sitting in university courses that covered medieval Minnesang and post-evaluar fricatives and Latin style exercises at 7 o'clock in the morning. Luckily, there was a university strike coming up. I joined in and never stopped striking, until I heard about the German School of Journalism in Munich and its legendary selection test. I'll give it a try, I thought. And until I got to that point, I read the newspaper for 3 hours a day for 6 months, memorized the strangest faces in the press photos and the workings of the UN and international exchange rate systems. And I was lucky I got accepted, and that also meant I had to study journalism at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, major subjects, political science, communication science, and economics. And I wanted to write, but about what? I wanted to be a journalist, but I didn't have a topic yet. At this point, I have to tell you briefly about Wolf. 58 years old, gray beard, gray hair. One day he was standing behind me in the cafeteria line, a bag full of plastic chips in his hand. And he told me about 50 semesters of studying English, medicine, philosophy, business administration, Portuguese, and so forth. I have to write about this man, I thought. It was my first article in Süddeutsche Zeitung, and I had discovered my topic, education and science. I wrote about visits of the Court of Auditors to Bavarian universities, about researchers in the fight against BSE, and during my time in the US, about college football players and their academic careers. I did my master's at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And if I can believe what my fellow students in Munich said, I avoided about 50 diploma exams in Germany. Although I would say, and I say that today, I really believe that, that I never learned as much as I did in my 2 years in the US at the university. And then in 2003, when I was back, was there the big breakthrough for the young journalists? Well, not quite. There was a media crisis. I did freelance work for various newspapers that was okay, but not very lucrative. I felt stuck somehow until I got a call from Die Zeit, and suddenly I felt I was somewhere where I belonged at the so-called Chancen Department, which means opportunities for education and science politics. Wonderful years, great colleagues. I wrote a lot and wrote even more. I became the deputy head of department and learned how to moderate panel discussions, political panel discussions, which also was a lot of fun. And at one of these panel discussions, I met Jürgen Mlinek, the then president of the Helmholtz Association, the largest German scientific organization. We liked each other. I interviewed him for Die Zeit later on. It was about Helmholtz and the question whether such a big organization actually is just boring and unactive, or can it actually make a difference, such a big organization. It was a nice conversation. Then nothing for a long time, until one day in 2012, he called me and asked if I wanted to be head of communications at Helmholtz, and I did. Wait a minute, somebody might say, how can that be? Somebody is so happy about being a journalist and a moderator, about seeing the world, and then he ends up as a press officer at Helmholtz Association in PR? Yes, and it was exactly right at that time, because I wanted to learn more about the world of science. And this time I had the feeling that I had to learn from inside of the world of science, see how such a large organization works, why things are so complicated sometimes, and why perhaps they cannot be much easier sometimes. But above all, can a research organization like Helmholtz also do public relations work that does not put its own institution above others, that does not stop at its own limits, but likes to talk about people and their curiosity, wherever they work, if they work with Helmholtz or not? Can such an organization enter a dialogue with society, invite critics, and then grow with those critics, at least occasionally? Whether I succeeded in doing this kind of PR work or not is not my role to judge. In any case, I had a lot of freedom, a lot of fun with my team, and we tried a lot of new things. Meanwhile, I was writing my dissertation, pretty late, I know, but a professor, an educational scientist who I knew from my journalistic work, called me one day and asked if I wanted to come and see him. He had an idea, he said, whether I would like to do scientific work again, to research the past and present, as you already heard, of the Max Planck Institute for Human Development and the understanding of science, the values of those who once worked there and who work there today. I found that incredibly exciting. And so I began five, almost 6 years of work while I was at Die Zeit doing, and Helmholtz then doing full-time work. Unfortunately, the professor has since passed away, but from the very beginning, I was lucky to have a whole team of smart scientists at my side who supported me, and I know what a privilege that was. But it was also tough, because I was, as I said, working full-time at Die Zeit, at Helmholtz, and after Helmholtz, again, full-time as a journalist, because in 2015, I was drawn back to journalism. I missed writing, commenting, and classifying education policy and science policy too much. But I didn't want to go back to a print medium, back to an institution, into hierarchies either. So I decided that I really wanted to work as a freelancer. A lot of my colleagues didn't really understand that because I had an unlimited time contract, both at Die Zeit and later a long time contract at Helmholtz, but I decided I want to do that. Nevertheless, I felt like this is the next thing I have to do. And this is what I still do today. I'm lucky that my work, my blog is of interest to some people, that newspapers like to buy my articles, and that I can earn some extra money as moderator or today as keynote speaker. And I think you can say you see a happy person in front of you today because I feel that I'm doing what I like to do. But does that qualify me to talk to you, a group of clever young scientists, about academic values? My excuse is simple. I was asked to talk to you. Whether rightly so, you have to decide for yourselves in the end. What I can bring with me, quite a lot of observations from my work as science journalist, as PR manager, as at a scientific organizations, a little of my own experience as a former and ultimately successful late bloomer doctoral student. What sets me apart from you, I was never a postdoc in science, never wanted to be a postdoc in science, because I never had the ambition to become a full-time scientist. But I do have the ambition to understand the scientific system and to be able to support it in my own way. And for me, that has long included thinking about values, academic values, the values of science. And yes, I admit, every now and then I also try to push the system a little into a direction that I believe would be good for it. That is my role as a journalist. That is also my role in speaking to you today. An expert on science, a former doctoral student, a journalist and observer, and I hope an observer with some values. What I planned for you today, first I would like to tackle a few questions that I consider to be central and to try answers in regard to values, academic values, answers that you are welcome to question and criticize later on in the discussion. Some of the questions: why do we need values in science? What is the difference between science and activism? What distinguishes a values-driven science from an ideological science? Are there academic values that are independent of certain disciplines, cultures, and value judgments? Then I will present a selection of seven from the multitude of conceivable values that I consider to be particularly important for scientists, especially for young scientists, and why I think so. And then I will discuss how these academic values are related to each other in my view, how they complement each other, but sometimes also contradict each other. And finally, I will talk about the power of academic values and what all of this could mean for you as young researchers. So why do we need values in science? We all talk about morals and values all the time, basically, just like it was natural. But I think it's worth taking a step back and asking yourself, why do we need academic values? Why do we need a moral compass? In my view, adding the moral compass is very important because values are similar, or talking about the moral compass is very important because values are similar to Paul Watzlawick's statement about communication. You can't not communicate. The same applies to science. You cannot do science without values. To put it more fundamentally, nothing we do or decide in life happens independently of the value system we have personally developed. Perhaps in many places, many instances, we are not even aware of our own values because we have not thought about them consciously, have not explicitly formulated them for ourselves, not put them down on a paper, but we have them and we live by them. However, just because everything we do is based on values and attitudes does not mean that they have to be good values in terms of moral points of views, morally outstanding values. An example: when scientists in the Third Reich carried out medical experiments in concentration camps and on inmates, they certainly justified this to themselves on ethical grounds, perhaps along the lines of the well-being of many through scientific progress outweighs the suffering of those prisoners. Perhaps they defined themselves through the academic value of a supposed scientific objectivity that should not be compromised by feelings, which also shows, by the way, that you can gloss over, so to speak, a lot with the right selection of values and their weighing, how you weigh them, which is why the moral compass I mentioned is needed so badly. What I mean by that term is every individual, but also every scientific institution needs something like an overall sensorium, maybe an overall philosophy of academic values against which all individual actions and decisions must be measured. I hope that what I mean by this will become clearer in the course of my keynote, but only with the help of this moral compass, we can avoid a dangerous value relativism in which we neglect or ignore competing values and interests in favor of a supposedly all-encompassing goal. Then and only then can the totality of our values be our moral compass in our decision-making processes, and the individual values serve as our ethical guardrails. But yes, we are then inevitably approaching a fine, thin line. The fine line between science and activism, between value-oriented science and ideological science. But what is the difference between those two? Perhaps I'm making it too easy for myself when answering this question, but in fact, the matter seems crystal clear to me at this point. The difference between science and activism is that in science, the interest of knowledge, the knowledge interest is completely open. In activism, it's not open. I can do science based on values without wanting to influence the cognitive process and the research results in line with my wishes. In other words, I have to do science without wanting to determine its results through my attitude. As a person, a scientist, I can certainly wish for a result, but my wish must not have any significance for the result. That for me is the difference between science and activism. As a social scientist, I can be convinced that the legalization of cannabis does not lead to more delinquency and psychological problems among young adults, but on the contrary, it might lead to decriminalization. But I should not influence research project with what I think is right, not with my conviction. I think that's pretty simple in a way. However, it does become more and more complex. We all are human and can sometimes deceive ourselves quite well with the assumption of our supposed objectivity. Or also we can deceive ourselves with the simple urge wanting to be right. But these are exactly the situations in which clear academic values and their realization serve as those guardrails I talked about and prevent activism rather than promote it. That I really have to be aware of my moral compass to see, well, there maybe I'm deceiving myself. The difference between value-based science and ideological science is the precise escalation of this conflict. Value-based science needs values as guardrails, not as goals. That's an important difference. And unlike ideological science, it does not set the single or a few values as absolute and above others. Wait a minute, you may reply at this point. What about values like human dignity? Are they not above others? Don't they have to be, and should we not make those values absolute? Yes, we should. But for me, human dignity and other human rights are part of the core of our human existence. We don't need to discuss them. And even more for me, they are inalienable and therefore not up for discussion. Or maybe they are, but only up for discussion in one context. For me, any science that violates basic human rights in any way is ideology, because for me, there's nothing more absolute than the relativization of human rights, which actually answers the next question that I wanted to ask myself in this lecture. Are there academic values that are independent of certain disciplines, cultures, and value judgments? And my answer is yes, there are. Above all other values, there are human dignity, human rights, and their observance. This may result in different different conclusions and consequences for each academic discipline, for each academic culture and value judgment, but their starting point is and remains the same. The specific conclusion is again made with the help of our indispensable moral compass, which I have already mentioned several times. At a lower level, there are other, let's call them universal academic values. So on the highest level, there are the human dignity, human rights, and their observance. And then on the lower level, there are the next level of universal academic values, and their selection definition is much more difficult and will be made somewhat differently by each person with the help of their own moral compass. Also somewhat differently by each academic community, I think. But you asked me today to talk about the value of academic values here and my academic values. And so there, here they are, my seven academic values. And we will perhaps discuss some of them more than others afterwards. But for me, they form a framework that can be used independently of certain academic disciplines and cultures. And they are impartiality, truthfulness, transparency, fairness, diversity, performance orientation, and social responsibility. So I'll start with impartiality. The great German television journalist Hans-Joachim Friedrichs once said, "You can recognize a good journalist by the fact that he does not associate himself with a cause, not even with a good cause." For me, the same applies to good scientists. Yes, I can, I may, I must have political convictions, but these convictions, as I said, must not influence my scientific work. My career decision, the decision for a certain discipline, of course, that is personal and also biased because I decide to go there. The choice of my research topic, of course, that also depends on my convictions, possibly also my political convictions. And the limits between those things are sometimes fluid. If empirical studies in educational science repeatedly show unequal educational opportunities, for example, as a core challenge of the German educational system, that can affect me personally and politically so much that I make this my research topic as a scientist. But as I said, I still have to remain impartial in my research work itself and the evaluation of the findings. As a journalist, I have it a little easier, or for me, it's a little easier, despite Hans-Joachim Friedrichs' statements. Commentary is a recognized genre in journalism, and I can and may be biased as part of my job doing commentaries. Scientists are allowed to do that too, but please make it transparent when you are speaking on the basis of scientific findings and when you are speaking on the basis of your own opinion. In the corona crisis, for the COVID crisis, for example, this differentiation and transparency has not always been successful in German science. It has not always been there, which brings me to the second, third, and fourth values, all three of which are closely related to one another. And this is truthfulness, transparency, and fairness, even more loaded words. What exactly does truthfulness mean to you, for example? Everyone would probably answer a little differently. For me, truthfulness in science means that I'm honest about what I know and what I don't know. Honest with myself and honest with others. It means that I don't exaggerate results, that I don't make them bigger than they are, that I put them in the context in which they belong. If I practice this form of truthfulness, then I also have to be transparent in my actions. How do I know what I know? Who helped me? What part did I play in a project and a publication? And what part did others play? What methods and instruments did I use? Am I biased in any way as a scientist? Do I have dependencies, social, financial, or any other kind of dependencies that are important for my work as a scientist? If so, I have to admit that to myself, first of all, that they are there. And the key word there is truthfulness again, and make them transparent to others. All of this is a question of responsibility and fairness. If we have finally started talking more about the abuse of power in German science for a while, then we are in the middle of a debate about the values of truthfulness, transparency, and fairness. People and institutions did not and do not want to admit that there is a widespread abuse of power from which young scientists, postdocs in particular, suffer. People and institutions were and are all too often not truthful. They cheat their way past an honest assessment and honest consequences. Fortunately, things are changing right now, only a little bit, but the courage to talk about those widespread violations is increasing, at least on an abstract level. Networks are forming, initiatives are getting louder. The concrete naming and prosecution of abuse of power in science is still very difficult, though. Transparency is far from being achieved in many places, but the pressure continues to grow, and that is a good thing. In few places is the transition between personal and institutional values as fluid as it is right there. The failure of those responsible to uphold values is matched by the failure of institutions that don't do enough to ensure that truthfulness, transparency, and fairness prevail. And because these are violations of academic values, it is not only the people affected that suffer serious damage, but science itself. It drives away talented people, allows their potential to be damaged, and tolerates scientific work that lacks truthfulness, transparency, and fairness. This, of course, has profound consequences for the quality of research. And this brings me almost automatically to the next point, or the next of my seven values, diversity. Science is as efficient as possible if it is as diverse as possible. Promoting diversity among scientific personnel is not quite a question of political correctness, social policy, or some kind of do-good attitude, as it's sometimes portrayed and often claimed by those who occupy the majority of academic positions of power, not because of their unique and outstanding intellect, but because their gender has protected them. Oftentimes their gender combined with traditional social networks, their upbringing, and career structures that were built by people who were just like them. So intelligent talent and potential are equally distributed among people. I'm sure of that. So I must be downright insane as a scientific system if I feed on only a small part of it. Then I am gambling away my quality and my future as a system, especially when other competing scientific systems around the world have long been more successful in exploiting and using the diversity of human talent potential. Yes, diversity is challenging. It's a challenging goal, and promoting it is complex and sometimes also expensive. But the opposite is much more expensive in the medium term. Apart from the sheer number of talents that you would otherwise never attract to science, this is also evident on a personal level. There is now pretty strong research evidence that diverse teams work more successfully, more creatively, and with more perspectives. And that the big disruptive insights and innovations happen at the transition on the lines between traditional disciplines. Because that is also an important understanding of diversity, the interaction of different disciplines, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary. Here too, it is difficult, especially at the beginning, to make it happen when you are untrained, but it's worth it, at least for society. Individually, that is still often not the case. The German Science Research Foundation, for example, the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, encourages scientists to undertake interdisciplinary projects. But during reviews, researchers who are actually brave enough to do interdisciplinary work complain that they then sit in front of representatives of the individual disciplines. And then they often have to justify their approach, their interdisciplinary approach, because those who are sitting there and reviewing them are not into interdisciplinary work. And they have to justify why they want to leave the thematic or the academic mainstream. Another problem for young scientists is that they would often like to conduct interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary research, but in order to maximize the chances of scientific project proposals, they ultimately choose the conservative monodisciplinary path with fewer prospects. Another point at which the disregard of what I consider to be a fundamental academic value, in this case, diversity, causes both personal damage, career damage, also damage to science as a whole and to scientific institutions. Back to this apparent contradiction that I just talked about, promoting diversity is not a question of political correctness, social policy, or a do-good attitude. Diversity and excellence are not opposites, they are interdependent. That is why diversity is closely linked to the next academic value that I would like to mention, performance orientation. Let's assume we open up the science system and academic career path. What would that actually mean? Clearly transparent access and also clear performance criteria and assessment standards, employment contracts and hierarchies that do not paralyze but enable. It would mean flexible working time models and social infrastructures that enable and promote development as a scientist, regardless of origin, parental income, or parenthood. Imagine the boost for scientific quality that could provide. How much would that shuffle the cards in the science system in a direction where talent, potential, and intellectual performance really matter? We would have arrived then at a real performance orientation that is not measured by status, seniority, or living conditions, but by scientific brilliance, adherence to academic values, and the courage to think in different ways. How would that stimulate scientific competition for quality and excellence? Because yes, I firmly believe in the importance of competition in science. I was, and I still am a fan of the excellence strategy, the continued existence of which is once again the subject of public debates right now. Public debates from which the federal and state science ministers, the reason for that is that those state ministers responsible for science in the federal system in the states are not so far taking part of. They are still kind of staying out of this debate, but more in a wait-and-see mode is my impression, because I don't think that most of them are still big fans of the excellence strategy. Why that is, perhaps more on that later. But as I said, I am and I will remain a fan of the excellence strategy. It is just that it is taking place under circumstances that threaten to discredit its value. Firstly, universities as a whole are so poorly funded that the academic competition for excellence and third-party funding often becomes a competition of starvation, whose shining winners cannot distract from, well, run-down buildings, precarious employment contracts, and neglected students. But that is not the fault of the competition or the idea of performance. That is the fault of a policy that, secondly, is not finally managing to create the better working conditions in science that it has long promised. The federal government is failing, probably finally, in this legislative period to implement the long overdue reform of the Academic Temporary Employment Act, the Wissenschaftszeitvertragsgesetz. Incidentally, this is another prerequisite for more diversity and excellence, that they would reform this act, even if some may dispute this. So please believe in the value of excellence and performance orientation. I'm sure you all do. I firmly believe in it. It's not the value that is the problem, but rather that politics are not allowing it to be properly recognized. So I'm almost finished with my selection of academic values. There's one left, social responsibility. What do I mean by that? First of all, it's kind of trivial. Science does not take place in a vacuum, not in an ivory tower. In the end, and I'm also firmly convinced of this, science always serves to make people's lives better. Even the science of those who perhaps subjectively only satisfy their own curiosity, their own interest in knowledge. Nevertheless, something has changed in recent years and decades. The speed with which scientific findings find their way into application, in which they sometimes fundamentally change our lives, has radically shortened. This means that society today has even greater expectations of salvation of science. But society also has greater fear of science because of the speed. Accordingly, it has increased greatly, no, not the social responsibility of science, that has always been great, but the debate about social responsibility of science, about the role of science for society. It should, as politicians also demand, become faster and better at technology transfer. It should better explain and publicly communicate what it does and research. And with all the speed, it must consider just as thoroughly as before the increasing complex social consequences that can result from its research and the knowledge it produces. And science is you. You are the science. No matter what field you are researching in, what scientific projects and knowledge you are pursuing, you have a comprehensive responsibility to science, its prosperity and well-being. You're financed by society. You work for society. Unlike in the past, it is much harder to evade this knowledge, to talk your way around or even out of it. You should therefore ask yourselves, how can you give something back to society? Whether it is in the form of a lecture to school children, or an appearance at the Long Night of Science, Lange Nacht der Wissenschaft, or even just by, talking about truthfulness again, really honestly thinking about the meaning and implications of your work. In the course of your scientific career, there will be enough opportunities to live up to the social responsibility of science, and please don't miss them. So those are my seven values: impartiality, truthfulness, transparency, fairness, diversity, performance orientation, and social responsibility. As I said, I'm looking forward to discussing them later with you about the selection and the way I described and defined them. But first, I would like to address a few points that I consider important in connection to these values I discussed. I've already said a lot about the fact that they are related to each other and about how they are related. But what if some of them, the ones I have listed, or completely different ones that are important to you that I have not listed, what if some of them seem to contradict each other? What do you do then? Perhaps you have noticed something, perhaps you have been waiting all this time and so far in vain for this word to come up. Perhaps as one of the most important, the decisive academic value of all, freedom, academic freedom. Have I forgotten this value? No, I have not, for several reasons. For me, academic freedom is not an academic value. It is one, indeed, the fundamental right in relation to the practice of science. As long as freedom is guaranteed, you have the freedom to define and live out your academic values for yourself. In this respect, each of the seven values that I have discussed is, of course, closely related to academic freedom. If you like, this freedom is even the decisive element that connects them all, conditions them, and by which they must be measured. The academic values that I have described can contradict each other, but none of them can or should contradict academic freedom. If they seem to do so, then we must talk about it. And I'm convinced that these only seem to be apparent contradictions. Let's talk about the example of performance orientation. If this is understood to mean declaring insecure working conditions as prerequisite and incentive for performance in the way that we need limited time contracts and short time contracts to be able to perform, then the academic freedom of the individual suffers at the same time. But the problem then, as I hope I have been able to show, is that not competition, or the problem is then, as I hope you have shown you, not competition or performance orientation per se, but its implementation by science policy and universities. But because I don't think that that competition demands the suffering of individual academic freedom. And what if some of the values I have listed or different ones that are important to you seem to contradict each other most of the time? I'm convinced here too, there will be no real contradictions, as I have tried to illustrate by the only apparent opposition between the only apparent opposition between excellence and diversity. There is no contradiction in there, but sometimes it might look like it. What about the goal of scientific excellence and the social responsibility of science, for example? Of course, as a scientist, I can want both and pursue them in my work. As excellence and social responsibility, of course, as a science policymaker, I also can demand and promote both. But in the end, especially at the beginning of my career, I often have to decide, do I publish one more paper or do I get involved in science communication? Do I strive to become a principal investigator in a research network that conducts basic research? Or do I get involved in a transfer project with the regional economy? And what about the goal of diversity and performance orientation? Am I not ultimately lying to myself if I encourage young scientists to start a family and at the same time not to scale back their career ambitions? You can wish for a different, more diversity-sensitive science, but the wish alone does not protect postdocs from reality, does it? No, I cannot argue them away, all these and other possible contradictions. I can only say for myself, the mere existence of such contradictions should not stop us from believing in the academic values that we are convinced to be right. At the same time, however, we should also approach our lives and in science with the necessary realism to know that naivety is certainly not an academic value I can recommend. But one thing is definitely not naive, believing in the power of academic values. I'm convinced that only those who develop a clear picture of themselves as scientists and of the academic values that guide them will be able to follow their path. It still won't be a straight path, it will be winding, but every detour will be the result of comparison, the comparison between your own value system and the challenge that lies ahead. This brings me back to the moral compass from before, the totality of our values, which individually serve as ethical guidelines or guardrails for us. How do these fit together in terms of like pictures, detours on the one hand, guardrails on the other hand? I think it fits well together because they are not erratic detours, not detours without a goal, but always with a clear goal in mind. We must not ever give up on our values, but it's perfectly fine if we do not always go head first into walls. It is perfectly fine as long as we can justify our decisions to detour sometimes to ourselves and our value systems. And if not, what if we witness how people are abused, how powerful superiors bully their subordinates, if research results are falsified or selection procedures are unfairly influenced? Then we should act. Then we have a social responsibility to act. Then it is about defending impartiality, truthfulness, transparency, fairness, diversity, and performance orientation. These are values with great power that make the difference between a prosperous science and a broken science. Enforcing them is not just a question of personal conviction, but of the reputation, quality, and resilience of science. But what exactly does that mean for every single scientist, for each and every one of you? We are currently at a transition. Science is in motion. A few years ago, the hierarchies at German universities and research institutions seem to be stuck in their ways. Abuse and academic misconduct were discussed more quietly than elsewhere, and the taboos were more extreme. I experienced this very clearly when I returned from the US in 2003. It was similar in journalism, by the way, back then. People were good at elevating themselves above the Americans, but when asked about ethical standards and processes and guidelines in their own country, in Germany, things quickly went quiet. Conflicts and academic misconduct are somehow sorted out among themselves, was the half-spoken answer sometimes. We do that among ourselves. All too often, only one rule seemed to prevail. Old white men don't scratch each other's eyes out, protect each other when it matters, and keep everyone else in their place where they belong. Fortunately, that has changed, at least to some degree. Science has changed in Germany to some degree. Networks have been founded against the abuse of power and for sustainable science. The first cases are being punished, at least. The representatives of doctoral students, postdocs, and junior professors are speaking out loudly and more confidently. Diversity is also growing in academic management, albeit slowly. Alternative forms of assessing science and research are being discussed, and the poor working conditions and future prospects of young scientists have been the subject of science policy discussions for years. At the same time, however, far too little is happening, far too slow. Will we have the already mentioned reform of the Wissenschaftszeitvertragsgesetz before the next federal election? I am becoming less and less convinced of this. And while everybody is talking about more career opportunities for postdocs, the austerity policy in many federal states in Germany and the federal level is now leading to cuts in precisely those positions that are temporary and could therefore potentially be eliminated, the positions for young scientists, which is a paradox that we talk about new career opportunities and new perspectives. And at the same time, the careers of young scientists, researchers, are the only one where actually the system can cut. My warning and encouragement at the end of my keynote, please do not let this put you off. You alone cannot change science, but you are part of a change that has long been underway and it's continuing. It may be that you will personally benefit from this along in your career. It may be that yourself will have to or want to leave academia. If you yourself progress and move up in the academic leadership ranks, then I have one request though. Please remember the debate about academic values that you have been having here in Konstanz at the Zukunftskolleg and in many other places for some time. Remember the academic values that you recognized as guiding and decisive for yourself, and act accordingly, even if you yourself are in a stronger position suddenly. Academic values are not a question of strength or weakness, they are a question of decency. But I really often experience that I talk to young researchers and about the values, and a couple of years later, I meet them again, and suddenly they are professors, and they say, yeah, you know, I have a different perspective now, it's not that clear cut, and da, da, da. Well, which brings me back to the beginning, to myself and the role in which I spoke to you today, as someone who, through his work as a journalist, tries to push the system a little bit into the direction that I believe would be good for it. I hope you will forgive me for this attempt, as I'm only an observer and not a scientist myself, but I love discussing with scientists, especially with young scientists. I can learn so much from them, and that's exactly what I'm looking forward in our upcoming discussion here at Castle Hohenfels, and I think first also I'm looking forward to some online questions. Thank you so much.